Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
The governor of the great state of California on the broadcast today, to tax or not to tax. He says tax, by the way, and cut, too. Turning out the lights in Detroit and New Orleans loses a daily newspaper. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Let Marketplace be your guide to the modern world. Subscribe to the Marketplace Tech Report podcast. Find it on iTunes or at marketplace.org/podcasts.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. This is the Marketplace podcast for Thursday, the 24th of May. Good to have you with us. There is the American dream. We've all heard of that one, right? And then there's California dreaming. Hollywood, Silicon Valley, beaches, and plenty of sunshine. Also, Sacramento, the capital. That's where Governor Jerry Brown announced last week that the budget gap out here is a little bit more than he'd originally guessed. All right, it's a lot more. It almost doubled to just shy of $16 billion. The governor's got a plan, though, spending cuts, and he wants to raise taxes, a higher sales tax, and a surcharge on the wealthy. Voters will get to decide. It'll be a ballot referendum in November, raising taxes on the rich to avoid drastic cuts in services for the poor.
The American dream.
Millionaires, billionaires.
Class warfare.
Paycheck to paycheck.
We pay our fair share.
As part of our continuing coverage of wealth and poverty on the broadcast, Governor Brown joins us. Welcome to the program.
Good to be here.
Seems to me what we have, sir, in this budget question is the defining issue of our political times, right? The question of what government does, social services, education, versus our willingness to pay for it. Where do you find the fulcrum? What's the balance point?
Well, the balance point is the budget itself and my willingness to either stand for balance or to fold like governors before me. Since I've been here before, I was governor from 1975 to January of 1983. I want to fix it, and it may take us a year or two, but we're going to get to the goal of living within our means.
Why is it that this debate, Governor, happens on the far ends of the economic spectrum? We're talking about cutting services for the most needy in our society and taxing the very richest. I mean, how do you reconcile that with an electorate that lives mostly in the middle?
Well, the electorate in the middle is telling every survey that they don't want any more taxes. They are willing to see the taxes on the most affluent increase at least temporarily if it's for schools, for public safety, and for the most vulnerable. So faced with a gap of $15.7 billion, I can either fold my tent and just slash away, or I can give the voters an opportunity to say, okay, we'd like to shoulder part of that burden.
What happens, Governor, if Californians opine against these taxes? Are you ready to let the cuts happen and then see how ready and willing people are actually to pay for what they get?
The cuts will be built into this year's budget very soon.
Yeah, but having them built in and letting them actually happen are two totally different things.
Are you ready to let it actually happen?
Wait,
I beg to differ with you. These will be automatic. That's why they're called trigger cuts. A no vote pulls the trigger, and we cannot finance our budget without borrowing. We cannot borrow unless our budget is truly balanced. It cannot be balanced without having automatic reduction in spending after the election if the voters so decide.
And then what happens? Do you think once these cuts go into effect, assuming Californians decide not to maintain the taxes, do you think people will finally realize the connection between services and getting what you pay for?
I think people know that you can't get something unless you pay for it. So there is no doubt that as this population ages, as the world gets more competitive, we're going to have to invest through the public sector more, not less. But now when people agree to that, I can't tell you. Mm. And if people don't, there will be a shrinkage over the next many years and decades.
How is it, do you suppose, Governor, that the issue of income inequality, of big government versus taxing the rich versus wealth and poverty and all of those dynamics in this economy today. How did it all get so political, right? How did we get here?
Well, I don't know how much history you know, but go back
a decent amount.
Take a look at the 1800 election between Adams and Jefferson. A lot of nastiness there. Look at some of the campaigns, what they said about Abraham Lincoln. Part of democracy is a measure of skullduggery and shaming and blaming. But somehow we've made it, and we'll continue if we find a few people of courage and clarity that can mobilize the better spirits of our people.
Well, let me continue with that theme then quickly, if I might. Isn't the essence of a representative democracy that we, the citizens, cede some of our power to you, our representatives, and you guys make the hard choices, right? How you doing so far on that one?
Well, I think we are making hard choices. Does it fit with what I was brought up as a good Catholic to think is right? No. This is not in accordance with what Jesus or Muhammad or any other prophet would have recommended. But here's the world we live in, and we're trying to make it the best way we can. I'm optimistic that California is going to set the example. California has created more patents. We got more venture capital. We have more Fortune 500 companies. We're on a path of recovery, and we're on a path, I believe, to resolve some of these deeper contradictions that in Washington they appear to be increasingly paralyzed by.
Jerry Brown, he's the governor of the state of California. Thanks a lot for your time, sir.
My pleasure.
Wall Street today was not on a path to recovery, not paralyzed either, just kind of there. It's going to be the mixed music when we do the numbers. Fans of gallows humor and veterans of failing companies will recognize this. The sign, often handwritten, that says, "Well, the last person out of whatever failing company it is, please turn off the lights." That could wind up being literally true for the city of Detroit. It's deep in debt. It's got a state-appointed board managing its finances, so it's got to cut services it can't afford. Services it can't afford, by the way, in part because it's a city built for 2 million people that is now home to just over 713,000 people. So streetlights might be a luxury that Detroit cannot completely afford, as Marketplace's Mitchell Hartman reports.
The city's Democratic mayor has floated a proposal to turn off half the city's streetlights. The idea is to do it in neighborhoods that are already blighted and mostly vacant. State legislation is about to be introduced to pay for upgrading and operating the lights that would be left on. And that's important because nearly half the city's streetlights are already busted. Jeff Horner teaches urban planning at Wayne State University. He was just talking to a student who bikes to school.
And she says, "You know, some nights I just go home after dark and I know I shouldn't be doing it." And I said, "No, you shouldn't be doing that because the city can be a dangerous place, especially when there's no lights."
And the city's plan means there will likely be more of those areas in the future. Bill Mitchell is co-founder of a neighborhood news website called Detroit143.org.
You're looking at approaching people who may be living in the only occupied house on their block and persuading them that their neighborhood really is dying and that they need to move.
Now, you might expect businesses to bridle at the city cutting back on something as basic as streetlights. It could mean having to close early and a higher risk of break-ins. Kathy Wendler is president of the Southwest Detroit Business Association.
My sense is that highly populated areas that do have concentrations of business to serve are not likely to lose lighting.
Wendler, a Detroit native, admits it's hard to recruit businesses and professionals to move into Detroit right now. Crime, poverty, and impending darkness don't help, but she still insists Detroit is worth a second look. She says housing is incredibly affordable, and some neighborhoods are still very vibrant. I'm Mitchell Hartman for Marketplace.
Here's today's mind-blowing but still somehow not surprising indicator of the way we live in the early 21st century. Best guesses are that every year here in the city of Los Angeles, we go through 2.3 billion of those plastic grocery store bags. That goes a long way to explaining why the city council has voted to ban them. L.A. is the biggest city in the country to do so. And once the ban phases in over the next year or so, a substitute paper bag is going to cost you 10 cents. But that's not so great for the environment either, as Marketplace's Adrian Hill reports.
Pity the grocery store checkers who settled into a paper or plastic routine and now need to come up with a really succinct way to ask, do you have your own bag? Or would you like to pay 10 cents for a paper bag? Or would you like to just carry these groceries out in your arms? I'm sure they're looking for suggestions. Plastic is on the way out in L.A.
Just great news for the oceans. It's great news also for our rivers. It's great news for our neighborhoods.
Mark Gold is associate director at UCLA's Institute of the Environment and Sustainability. Plastic sticks around, he says. It gets hung up in trees, snagged in drains. It's easy to see the pollution it causes. But paper? It's got problems, too. Darby Hoover is with the Natural Resources Defense Council.
Anytime you have a disposable bag, a bag that's designed for one and or maybe two uses at most, you're investing energy, materials, water, materials like trees, into the production of this bag.
Making paper bags creates greenhouse gases, water pollution, and urban policymakers, they know this stuff.
They both have environmental problems. We ultimately want to see them both disappear.
David Assman is the deputy director of the Department of the Environment in San Francisco, which also has a plastic bag ban.
Banning both outright overnight would cause disruptions in the system. People wouldn't necessarily be prepared. We see this as a progressive policy.
Where the checker of the future simply asks, do you have a bag you'd like me to use? Might want to watch your back, paper. I'm Adrian Hill for Marketplace.
Goldman Sachs is often called the most powerful investment bank on Wall Street because it is. But the years since the financial crisis have not been kind to Goldman Sachs. A former member of its board of directors is on trial this week for insider trading. Goldman was involved in the botched Facebook IPO, so one might reasonably assume the bank's annual shareholder meeting today would be tempestuous. Our New York bureau chief Heidi Moore was there.
Sister Barbara Ayers of the Interfaith Center for Corporate Responsibility still remembers the day that Goldman Sachs CEO Lloyd Blankfein joked that his firm was doing God's work.
Well, we weren't particularly thrilled with the outcome of that particular God's work at the time.
She means all the financial hanky-panky that led up to the crisis. Sister Barbara braved the rain and intense security today to urge Blankfein to use his powers for good. She was one of 200 shareholders who attended Goldman's annual meeting in Jersey City, New Jersey. Shareholder Stephen Viederman didn't mind the schlep from New York.
This is always good theater, if nothing else.
But there was more laughter than dramatic tension. Blankfein, who's known for his sharp wit and skeptical expressions, was on his best behavior, says Sister Barbara. She jokingly asked him for a job. He retorted he couldn't outbid her celestial boss.
I've seen him when he was a little upset, and today I thought he handled himself quite well. Tempered, allowed people to speak. He didn't cut anybody off.
Only about seven shareholders in the sparse room asked questions. Blankfein's thorough responses seemed like part of Goldman's friendly image makeover. In an ongoing charm offensive, the firm embraced the masses today to join Twitter. In fact, the meeting was so calm that Viederman, a shareholder, noticed that at least one member of the board of directors was taking care of other business.
I did, while I was sitting in the back of the room watching the dynamics, see at least one doing his BlackBerry.
No shareholder spring here. Goldman's investors voted for everything Goldman's management wanted. In New York, I'm Heidi Moore for Marketplace.
Leaders of all the 27 member nations of the European Union met for dinner last night in Brussels. The food really was just an excuse to get together. They had Greece to talk about and what to do about the rest of the European economy as well. The Germans, as you know, want austerity. The French want government spending to get growth going again. And it's a debate that's being heard here as well, which leads us to ask, what do you think?
And the latest poll numbers suggest margin of error.
There is somewhat of a disconnect.
It's conventional wisdom.
Our survey said...
Frank Newport, the editor-in-chief at Gallup, is here with us every week to give us an attitude check, what Americans really think about the news of the week. Frank, it's good to talk to you again.
Good to be with you.
All right, so here's what we did. Once again, we went out and did our own little survey, just, you know, not that you guys should be threatened, but we thought we'd get some people on the radio. Here's what they said about austerity and growth.
We should save and we shouldn't spend money.
Growth, right? That'd be the best for the nations there, for them to be able to grow.
I
think austerity, because if you tend to throw more money at a bad situation, people tend not to clean it up.
The more people spend, the more money that goes into the nation, I believe, so the country could pay off its debt.
Unfortunately, they're going to need both.
I think that's probably it, right? Both? Is that what people said?
Yes. The last real person you talked to in the street actually had it nailed. We didn't ask Americans to choose in this latest survey. We said, how important is each of the following? And one of them was the budget deficit and debt, and another was weak economic growth. And guess what? Both were rated almost equally and very highly in terms of importance to Americans.
Explain to me how that can be. How can it be that both are important?
Well, again, it's not a forced trade-off. Americans say, you know, I would like to have no debt. I would also like to have the economy booming. Both of these things are important, and they're saying to presidential candidates and politicians, tackle both of these issues. Thank you very much.
I don't know if you noticed, but all of the women in our survey said austerity is important, and all of the men said growth. Does it break down on gender lines?
Not a lot of difference, but the difference that is there really mirrors politics today. And I don't know how random your sample was, but women today are more likely to be Democratic and men are more likely to be Republican. So I think in general, we would find republicanly oriented men saying that the deficit is more important than would women.
Right. Now, this is nominally a survey about the American economy. And you guys go ask about how things are going here. Do you have data on Europe and what people think about austerity and growth over there?
We don't have data from Europeans themselves,
because
you really have to say, well, do people in Greece differ than people in Germany and so on and so forth? The one thing that we have found consistently here domestically in the U.S. is that Americans aren't paying that much attention. In fact, internationally, Americans are more worried about China and the possibility that Iran might hurt oil supplies than they are what's going on in Europe.
That's kind of amazing. Frank Newport is the editor-in-chief at Gallup. The segment we do with him every week is called Attitude Check. There's more about it on our website. It's marketplace.org. Frank, thanks a lot.
My pleasure.
Coming up, New Orleans and its paper of record.
It was a time when institutions in New Orleans either stepped up or faded away. And there's no question the Times-Picayune stepped up.
The fate of the Times-Picayune. But first, let's do the numbers. So as I said, a mixed day on Wall Street today. The Dow Industrials edged up 0.25%. That's 33 points, 12,529. The Nasdaq lost 0.33%, 10 points, 2839 at the bell. The S&P 500 up 0.1%. That's a point. Finished at 1320. Most financials fell. Citigroup off 1.8%. Goldman Sachs down 1.2%. J.P. Morgan Chase off 0.8% today. Airlines soared on an analyst report predicting cheaper jet fuel. U.S. Air flew up 10%. United climbed 5%. Delta and Southwest each picked up more than 4% today. Tiffany sadly lost its sparkle, dipped 7% on slower sales and a dimmer outlook. In tech, data storage company NetApp took a 12% hit on weak earnings. Facebook gained another 3% today. Bond prices fell. The yield on the 10-year T-note rose to 1.78%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Do you enjoy the music we play between stories? Visit the Marketplace music section to browse playlists for all of our programs and to buy those songs on Amazon. A percentage of each purchase goes towards supporting our programs. Find more online at marketplace.org/music.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a look at events coming up Friday. In Arlington, Virginia, Vice President Joe Biden will deliver remarks at the 18th annual TAP Seminar for surviving families of those who died in military service to our country. Otherwise, Friday will be a quiet one in the nation's capital ahead of the Memorial Day weekend. If you feel your inner Wookiee stirring, don't be alarmed. On this date in 1977, Star Wars hit the silver screen for the very first time. I'm Joel Patterson.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. It's about to get harder to find a copy of the local paper down in New Orleans, an actual paper copy of the paper. The company that owns the Times-Picayune said today it's cutting staff and production. The print edition is going to come out just 3 days a week, as Marketplace's David Gura reports.
Here's one of the secrets of the newspaper business.
Many days a week, particularly Monday and Tuesday, lots of newspapers lose lots of money.
That's Jerry Seppos. He used to be an editor. Now he teaches at LSU in Baton Rouge. Seppos says a publisher knows the good days when the paper is thick with ads. Thursday and Friday, heading into the weekend, and on Sunday. Papers printed early in the week can be so thin, Seppo says, they almost fly away. These last few years have been tough for the Times-Picayune. Byron Martin works at Lakeside News, a newsstand in Metairie, just a couple blocks from Lake Pontchartrain.
It still sells okay. It doesn't sell anywhere near when it used to.
The papers had to deal with the economic downturn, then there's the national trend of fewer people reading newspapers. And after Hurricane Katrina, thousands of people left New Orleans, including many Times-Picayune subscribers. Martin says the paper has changed since then.
It's gotten much smaller, it's more expensive, and I don't think the content is what it used to be.
Starting this fall, a print edition of the Times-Picayune will be available on Wednesdays, Fridays, and Sundays. Paul Gillen runs a blog called Newspaper Death Watch.
This has been a quiet phenomenon. A lot of papers have cut back on schedules without really talking about it.
The company that owns the Times-Picayune made this change at a newspaper it owns in Ann Arbor, Michigan. And it's going to happen at three other newspapers in Alabama. Gillen says this may be a glimpse of the future.
You know, we'll still have major metro papers 5, 10, 15 years from now, but they probably won't be daily.
Gillen says they may produce material in print and online, or maybe just for the web. I'm David Gura for Marketplace.
The thing about the Times-Picayune is that it isn't just any daily paper. And that's really a function of the recent history of the city that it serves. During Katrina and right afterward, local radio and the Times-Picayune were often the only things holding New Orleans together. Chris Rose worked at the paper for 25 years, including Katrina and the aftermath, and he helped the paper win two Pulitzers for its coverage of the storm. So we figured he'd be a good guy to talk to about what the Times-Picayune means to New Orleans. We tracked him down on vacation on a cell phone, we should tell you, so the sound is kind of sketchy. But still, Chris Rose, it's good to have you with us.
Well, it's a pleasure to be here, I guess.
Yeah, well, that's the thing, right? I mean, this is a family radio show, so we can't use the words that you used when my producer broke this news to you this morning. But you were surprised.
Well, yeah, surprised, shocked, saddened. You know, I spent 25 years at that newspaper and never, I remember back in journalism school when they told us one day newspapers would be a thing of the past, and I always found it hard to believe. I figured as long as there were subways and men's rooms, there would be newspapers, but apparently the day has come.
One of our reporters in Washington, David Gura, who just did the story before our interview, was talking to a guy down in New Orleans today, and he said, what are we going to do for crawfish boils, man, without the newspaper down there? Everybody uses this thing.
Well, ain't that the truth? You know, it's a seafood town, so we're going to be at a loss. We'll find something with the free weeklies. But, yeah, the Times-Picayune is such an institution in that town that you had to figure the dominoes were going to drop across this country, but I didn't figure it happening in New Orleans this early.
Yeah, well, and especially because of what happened after Katrina, right? And that paper really being a lifeline for so many people.
It really was. But, you know, maybe that shows something, because you got to realize in the first days after Katrina, of course, we weren't publishing a newspaper. We were online.
Right.
Probably our greatest days and our greatest work happened online, but that's still still not much consolation. You know, it's one of these towns. It's filled with coffee shops and bar rooms and barber shops, and the newspaper is omnipresent there.
Yeah. You wrote in October of 2006, about a year after Katrina, you wrote a column on your own deterioration. I mean, your I think you called it a descent into hell, what that storm had done to you.
And deterioration is not a term I've ever assigned to it, but it's perfectly accurate. Yeah, I went mad in the months and year covering that storm and the desolation and the suicides and the destruction. It was crazy. It was crazy. But to tie it into the topic of the newspaper, I mean, that's what we did. We were warriors. We were war correspondents, and it was a time when institutions in New Orleans either stepped up were faded away, and there's no question the Times-Picayune stepped up.
Do you think, Chris, that there's a way that a website does what the hard copy of this newspaper did in this town?
No, I just, you know, I know everybody's got their handheld devices, and you can bring them anywhere, and you can read it anywhere, but the newspaper has it all there in your hands, the obituaries, the high school sports, the zoning issues, the DWIs. Who else is going to publish the DWIs? It's crazy.
Chris Rose was for many years a staff writer and a columnist at the Times-Picayune down in New Orleans. We got him on vacation on a cell phone somewhere not in Alabama. Chris, thanks a lot.
Thank you very much, Kai.
Chris's columns from 5 or 6 years ago, pretty gripping stuff. We've got a couple of them on our website. He put them together in a book, too. It's called One Dead in Attic.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Marshall School of Business.
This final note today in which we pose this question. Who ran for president this year in the GOP primaries and is the only politician on the AARP's list of the sexiest men over 50? I'll give you a second because, you know, Ron Paul is kind of charming. Rick Perry does have a certain something, and there's Newt, if you like the cerebral type. No, it was John Huntsman made the grade. He joins George Clooney, Denzel Washington, and Yo-Yo Ma on the list, even though Huntsman did say that he would vote to cut retiree benefits. How do you like them apples? All right, that's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow edged up 0.25%, about 33 points, 12,529 at the bell. The NASDAQ down 0.33%, 10 points, 2839. The S&P 500 nearly flat, up 0.1%, 1 point, finished at 1320. John Buckley, Nancy Fargali, Stephen Gregory, John Haas, Jonathan Karp, Sylvester Monroe, Betsy Streisand, and Celeste Wesson are the Marketplace editing staff. The managing editor is George Judson. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow. This is APM.
The world can be a confusing place for kids, and finding the words to explain it all can be tricky, too. Introducing Million Bazillion, a Webby-winning podcast from Marketplace that takes your kids on exciting adventures to answer the awkward and complex questions they have about money. Each week, we tackle hard-hitting inquiries from kid listeners like,
what is a college account and how does it work?
I want to know what unions are and what they are for.
Why does the U.S. have so much gold in Fort Knox and what do they use it for?
Help your kids understand how money fits into the world around us. Listen to Million Bazillion wherever you get your podcasts.